The Guardian.
During March, The Guardian's podcasts are sponsored by audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/free download to find out more.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski, and on this week's podcast, Keith Stewart reports back from the glitz and the glamour of the video game BAFTAs, the annual knees-up that celebrates the best and the brightest of the interactive entertainment industry. We will be hearing this week also about how Apple's decision to pay dividends to its shareholders may affect the company's reputation for innovation, and how much reputational damage actually hit the company as a result of stories, both fictional and not, about worker abuses at its manufacturing plant in China. We're finding out about the malware attacks on Syrian anti-government activists' computers, and Charles will be unpicking the future of the Google Android market as developers become increasingly frustrated by the fragmented platform. And hackers say, note, so far only say, that they will take to the skies in an attempt to avoid shutdown. Ooh, very exciting. Join us for the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Keith Stewart joins us in the studio.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you seem to have come down. You've taken your tux off, at least.
Yeah. I had the world's cheapest tux. I've given up on renting them now. I figure if I got this really cheap one from Marks and Spencer's, probably could have set all the electronics in the room aflame if I'd have rubbed anything vigorously, which is unlikely in the past.
You've arrived if you own a tux. That's pretty awesome.
Seriously, it's so insultingly cheap. If the BAFTAs found out, I'd never be allowed back in the building.
Charles Arthur also joins us. Charles, do you own a tux?
Indeed, I do not.
Well, yesterday, actually, you were at the London Web Summit, and I noticed on the email they had a strict dress code. There were no ties allowed. You were definitely amongst your people because you went to that event. This week, Apple's CEO Tim Cook announced that the company will start paying out dividends to its shareholders. Apple, which is one of a handful of firms worth over $500 billion, is currently the most valuable company in the world. They are sitting on almost $100 billion, which, Charles, they will be distributing to their shareholders.
Not all of it. They're going to be distributing about $45 billion over the next 3 years. So that's about $15 billion a year, which is about, $3 billion a quarter. The dividend is interesting. This is the first time since 1995 that they've paid a dividend. 1995 is when they began to slide into their near-death experience, which culminated in sort of 97, 98 with them losing $1 billion in the year. Steve Jobs, when he came back in 96, 97, wasn't really in the mood to start giving out money in the form of dividends and never introduced it afterwards. But Tim Cook, the new chief executive since August, seems to think that it's a good idea.
They're sitting on a cash purse of that much, and they can start sharing the love.
It's interesting because this $100 billion isn't actually all sort of dollar bills sitting in a great big vault.
Yeah, if it was, I'd love
Cupertino,
that address.
You know, it'd be like, they don't sort of say, okay, you're an executive now, you can go play in the vault. It's really not like that. Actually, $65 billion of it is cash and investments, which is lying outside the US. And if they were to bring it back into the US, they would face a big tax liability. So actually, they're only going into the money that's in the US at the moment. Big slice of this $100 billion is not strictly cash. It's what's called cash or short-term equivalents, which are sort of bonds that can be converted quickly, or long-term equivalents, and that's actually the majority, which is things like 10-year bonds, 15-year bonds, probably a lot of US treasuries in there.
Why have they decided to do this now?
It's rather hard to know, actually. I mean, I guess that it's, you know, if you've got this huge amount of money sitting there, they don't want to spend it buying a display company. You know, there was some speculation that they might have bought the spin-off of Samsung and Sharp and got their own display company. They're not looking to buy a flash memory company. You know, they're not doing any of those sort of vertical integration things, which is what you'd really think you might do with that sort of money. Paying a dividend, I guess, is actually the sort of thing that you're going to do. You're a big company. If you don't want to attract investors, then, you know, paying a dividend makes sense. Given the price of the stock, which is now north of $600, the yield, which is how much you get in your dividend, given how much it costs you to buy a share, is actually pretty low. It's about 1.7%, which is not great compared to other companies. So I don't think Warren Buffett's going to be piling in anytime soon to solve the question of, well, what do you do with a problem like $100 billion?
Is it not also for a positive reputation vibe amongst their shareholders?
A lot of the shareholders who've held stock over the past 10 years or so, you know, since it went through all the near-death and experience and stuff, have actually been holding it just for the appreciation of the stock, you know, that the stock would go up in value. So a lot of what are in the US called 401ks, which are retirement plans, they buy stock not necessarily because it's going to pay a dividend, which is how a lot of pension funds work, but because the stock will appreciate, you can sell it off, then you have a nice big cash pile and you live off the cash pile.
Charles, how is this going to affect Apple's share price in the short term?
I would expect in the short term that it's actually going to increase it. Because, you know, if you're paying a dividend, that makes it attractive. Even at the PE of 30 or so, you know, the price earnings, as in how many years does it take to pay back? I think it's around 30, or it might be 15. But it's still quite a long time to get your money back.
I imagine now that the shareholders are going to start seeing some kickback, that this would change their relationship with the company. Will they be more psychologically invested in what happens?
I think the shareholders have been along for the ride are probably going have been pretty invested in it anyway, because, you know, it was for the people who bought it back in 2001 or so, before they didn't come up with the iPod and stuff. You know, buying Apple shares then was really an act of faith. Yeah, you know, it was a sort of a statement for a lot of people then. More recently, as investors have piled in, you know, and pushed the stock up, well, that's all been about an increase in the stock value. I think that now that they're paying a dividend, there becomes a reason for people to hold on to it. The share becomes more valuable.
There has been some suggestion that this is a move to try and get other big companies like Google to start paying dividends. Is this a realistic postulation?
It does make Apple's shares more attractive. But what you've got to remember is that inside the company, the share price has no effect at all. Okay, for Google, it doesn't matter if their share price today is $10 or $40. It doesn't actually make any difference to the business, because the business carries on no matter what's happened to the shares. The shares are all out there. Google doesn't own shares. Pretty much all the shares that have been traded, it doesn't matter what their price is. It only affects them in terms of how easy or difficult it is to get a bank loan, for example. Actually, if people think that Google's share price is going to continue to go up because it's going to continue to make profits, because it's going to continue to get bigger, it doesn't make a difference what Apple's doing with the dividend.
In other Apple news, the company was recently under fire in a very public way for the alleged workers' abuses at Foxconn, which is a manufacturing company in China that builds most of Apple's products and also other companies' products. Is there any evidence that these accusations have affected their sales?
There doesn't seem to be any evidence that the accusations about Foxconn have made any impact on it. It's had bigger and bigger quarters. What you're referring to here is a really intriguing tale of lies, basically, and accusations and truth, and how the three of them all get mixed into a big potpourri.
There most recently was a story that was a theater piece that was broadcast on an American radio program. That is the thing that really has created this firestorm. But we've been talking about Foxconn for a while. So this is even outside the context of the difficulties that have arisen about Foxconn and truth.
It's been a bit in parallel. The latest is all about a guy called Mike Daisy, who's a playwright, an American playwright, who has done a lot of one-man shows. His first one was called 21 Dog Years, which is about working at Amazon for 3 years. And he did a stage play about the conditions inside working at Amazon.com. Then he got interested by what was going on at Apple's suppliers, people like Foxconn. I think this would be back sort of 2010 or so, when stories about suicides, you know, worker suicides came up. And so he decided to go and try to find out what he could about it. He made a visit to Shenzhen, and he went for 6 days, and he had a Chinese translator, English to Chinese translator, called Kathy Lee, who subsequently has said that a lot of the things that Mike Daisy uses in his one-man show, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, which is available on the mikedaisy.blogspot.com website. Daisy is spelled with an E, by the way. She has said a lot of the things he said happened, such as a man with a withered hand, which had been crushed working on the iPad line, underage workers on the line saying that they're 13-year-olds, old guns in the hands of guards at the Foxconn gates. The Chinese translator said these things didn't happen. The meetings with workers who had been poisoned by N-hexane, which is used in the iPhone production, he didn't meet them. So although all these things might be true, although Foxconn has always rejected the idea that there are underage workers. Although the fact is that there were workers who were poisoned by N-hexane, there were workers who were injured in an explosion in an iPlaid manufacturing line. All these things are true, but his claim to have met people to whom these things had happened is not true. And he represented it as being true to journalists up and down the line, people from Associated Press, people from Bloomberg, and also to This American Life, which is produced by an American radio company. This American Life is then broadcast by NPR. They retracted it on Friday and have put out a new episode in which Ira Glass, who's the journalist who led it, interviews Mike Daisy and puts it to him that basically he's lied to them.
Well, what's interesting about this story, though, is the distinction that Daisy himself makes between writing for the theater, even though it's a documentary theater piece, it's an account. It's got a perspective, and this idea of journalism and the problem seems to have arisen that people have interpreted his one-man show as journalism as opposed to theater.
Now, that's not true. He actually went around and said, these things happened. And when people said to him, did these things really happen to you? You really met these people? He said, yes. That is not true.
So that's actually where the problem has come in.
That is
with
absolutely
the Mike Daisy.
He you can find multiple examples of people who said, so I put it to him that this was not true. Or, you know, they said, so these, you really said these things? He absolutely says, yes, I met the underage workers. Yes, I met the man with the withered hand. But that is not true. His interpreter says it's not true. He is now acknowledging that it's not true by saying, this is theatre, it's not journalism. Why did you think I was doing journalism? I was doing theatre. You can't have it both ways. It's either theatre or it's journalism. And people understand the difference between the two. You know, it's important, actually, that workers and Foxconn should be in conditions that we would like. You know, because Apple has, you know, $100 billion sitting around. It could, you know, it could buy Foxconn. You know, if you really wanted to make one little corner of China better, sure, they could do that. But for Mike Daisy to go around and say, these are things which I've experienced and I'm making a theatre play out of them, my experiences, that's really not the same at all.
So it's an interesting issue here because it's actually not a story about Apple, except that Apple has been implicated in the story.
Sure. I mean, years ago, it might have been Nike. You know, he might have been going and saying, you know, I went to the Nike factory and I saw underage workers and I saw a man with a withered hand where it had been, you know, hitting the shoe press or something.
How has this Foxconn story on This American Life affected people's perceptions of Apple? You suggested that the Foxconn story hasn't actually impacted the bottom line, that they're growing year on year. It was getting a lot of traction even before the retraction came along.
Mm-hmm. It's something which has risen to people's consciousness, I think, and full marks the Mike Daisy in as much as his act of theatre has brought it to more people's attention. And it's an important point. Though to some extent, it's all about where do you want your goods made? Look around your house. Look at the things that you own. How many of them have Made in China stamped on them? Do you know how they were made? Do you know how much the person who made them got? Do you know what the conditions were? No, you don't, generally. You can argue for a fairer world, and that's a good thing to do. And, you know, The Guardian would actually absolutely support that. But the problem comes when you try to argue for that, but you don't do it from a position of fact, when you do it from a position of fabulism. You know, that's when it gets difficult.
It doesn't even seem to change when the situation impacts on the consumer. I mean, we can look at what's happened with Foxconn and say, well, people aren't directly infected, they can easily put it to the back of their minds. So if you look at what happened with the Xbox with the sort of famous red ring of death, and when they saw something like 15-20% of the machines malfunctioning and going wrong, there wasn't a massive critical backlash against Microsoft, and it's just had probably its best year for Xbox so far last year. So it's astounding, really, how people are kind of lackadaisical about taking on technology companies and really understanding the manufacturing process, even when it impacts heavily on them as consumers.
The thing with the red rings of death, though, was that was actually down to a manufacturing defect, in effect. It was about heat sinks and stuff. I think that seems to be the suggestion. It wasn't that, you know, the staff and the Xbox production line were being overworked and couldn't get the stuff together because the parts were going past too quickly for them to get it assembled.
No, but it's this sense of process and taking on giant manufacturing companies that make our lives very comfortable and enjoyable as consumers. No one seems to be willing to, but there seems to be no kind of groundswell when these things happen.
Well, it's not even just within technology companies. There have been exposés about manufacturers of sporting equipment, of high street retailers as well. It's just a Western first world lethargy, I believe. And then there are those out there who do try and actually take this on. The problem is, as Charles, you're saying, is when the representation is fact, when in fact it's not necessarily.
I mean,
the
New York Times did a fantastic series in January about conditions in China, why Apple chose to manufacture in China rather than the US, for example. Yeah, it's a fantastic series. I recommend it to everyone. And that is all about fact. And it shows that, you know, conditions in China, not great necessarily. And then you have to ask the question of, well, are the conditions in China on the Foxconn lines less great than being in a rural area of China, or are they more great, or are they sort of, you know, trade-offs? You quickly realize that you're dealing with issues which are so gigantic that it's really hard as an individual to make a difference, for one thing, but even to make a decision about where should you go.
Well, video sharing site YouTube has become an important place for people inside Syria to get information about the current conflict raging around them and also to share intelligence from their perspectives with the rest of the world. However, Charles, you recently reported that people within Syria looking at videos about the conflict are being targeted by Syrian pro-government activists. How? What's the story here?
There are some fake links being sent out to the anti-government activists, which will direct them to a fake YouTube site. It looks just like the fake YouTube. It has YouTube in the URL. So to the casual eye, it looks as though it's the real thing. It offers people a flash update, so it offers to, you know, update the software on their machine. And also, when you want to leave a comment, it asks for your login details. Both those things. The first one with the flash update is actually installing malware, which would be able to track what's happening on the machine. And the other, the login details, obviously, is capturing your Google login, which now is shared, of course, across not just your YouTube login, but also your Gmail. So that's one consequence of Google pulling together all these things, is that your YouTube and your Gmail, whereas it used to be you could have different profiles and separate, you know, separate existences almost. Now those two are tied very closely together. So
your
if
one
is compromised, the other is. Examination by Symantec has shown that this malware and previous efforts of malware aimed at people who are, you know, going to look at these anti-Syrian government videos has been linking back to an IP address, and I confirmed this myself, within the Syrian Telecommunications Authority's IP space. And it seems pretty unlikely that it would be, you know, anti-government activists who would be, you know, rooting each other's machines to get at things. The fact that this directs back to a Syrian address space indicates to researchers that this is something by the Syrian pro-government activists. For Syrian activists who are looking to put these videos out or looking to view videos to understand what's going on inside their country, you know, even if they're living outside Syria and they're just going to the site to look at it, you know, this carries great risks because it could compromise their machines, that compromises the people they communicate with, and that could eventually compromise people inside Syria who would come to the attention of the government.
How common is this? This kind of government activism?
That's really hard to say, but it's increasingly being used as a tool. I mean, as YouTube especially becomes a more important tool for getting these sorts of messages out, you do see efforts by repressive governments to get hold of what's going on in people's machines. So, for example, Tibetan activists had their machines hacked with malware, which was logging their Gmail accounts, which was, you know, following what they were doing, and which would then spread itself to other activists' accounts. So, pro-Chinese government forces, I think you would say, were behind that one.
This is an interesting distinction, isn't it, between the notion of a private and a public space and how it extends to your computer. Because what we would expect and what we would hope is that we have a machine on our desk that is our property and therefore we have control over it. But what you're saying is that now it seems that people are essentially trying to take that over and make that into a public property for the benefit of and for the protection of a regime, of a nation state.
I mean, it's because computers tend to be a nexus of all sorts of contacts. They're the way through which we now tend to communicate with people. So, you know, any phone has lots of phone numbers and names attached to it, and, you know, many computers do as well because they store contacts lists. I mean, what you really need is a computer which is hard to hack. And, you know, to that end, I would have thought that, weird though it sound, the activists would be better off with, you know, tablets of one sort or another and, things like that. It sounds completely bizarre, but those won't be vulnerable to a flash update. And, the login details is a harder one, but at least you're slightly safer.
Also this week, the app's development community is reportedly falling out of love with the open source platform Android, according to a new survey released by AppCelerator, the website. The Register reported that this week. AppCelerator is arguing that the decentralized development environment is affecting Android's position on the must-code-for lists of many developers, resulting in a downward trend of engaging with this language for handheld devices. Charles, tell me the story here. How much of a threat is this?
What AppCelerator did was, in January, they surveyed developers and they got about 1% of those who are using their mobile development platform. So you could say, well, this is a pretty small picture already, but it's a consistent picture. And as much as they've been doing these surveys since sort of January 2010, and what they've seen is that the interest in iOS, which is Apple's iPhone and iPad platform, has been consistently high. You know, it's been around the sort of 90% amount, which is the number of developers saying, "Yep, we're going to code for that." When it comes to iPad, that's sort of rocketed. That, you know, took off obviously in January 2010, and since then, that's been around the same sort of level. For Android, the figures indicate that although interest was sort of at iPad sort of levels, 85% or so in around about January of last year and on, since then it started to drop off. And for Android tablets, that had a rise in, you know, January 2011 or so to around about 70%. That also is seeing a similar drop off to the level now where Android tablets gets about the same amount of interest as coding HTML5 for the mobile web, where you're talking around 65% interest from developers. So what we're saying here is that there's much more interest in coding for the iPhone than there is for Android and Android tablets, to the extent that they're thinking about HTML5 rather than Android tablets.
But is that because of this apparent fragmentation of the system, or is it just simply a trend?
Why would developers not want to code for Android? You know, it's the biggest smartphone platform that there is out there. It's selling half the handsets every quarter in the smartphone space. Apple has got about a quarter. So, you know, why else?
Yeah, fragmentation is huge. And I mean, what we're getting now is a kind of microcosm of the Java handset market in about 2005, isn't it? Where you had this
old school.
Yeah, he had this vast array of platforms. And I used to speak to developers back in sort of 2004, 2005, and they'd take me into their studios and they'd have these drawers full of like 800, 900 phones, and they had to test their apps on each one of those. And Google Android devices are nowhere near that, but they're heading in that direction. I mean, there's different architectures, different hardware, different real estate on the site, on the screen, different controls. And we are heading towards that kind of Java, that ridiculous Java era of having to test your apps on 700 devices.
What is the games landscape on Android?
It's complex. It's difficult. The Android market isn't the greatest place to try and find games, and there aren't as many. Even just from my own experience of being offered games to review, there's nowhere near as many products that were offered on Android, and I think that fragmentation is actually part of that. And the difficulty of bringing a game to market and monetizing it on Google Android is difficult. There's lots of games out there, some really good games, but it's just the market isn't as easy for small studios to make an impact in.
So Charles, is fragmentation that you and Keith are talking about, is this an expected part of open source development? Because people can create different systems. Open source environment, the open source development environment is kind of rife with stories of fragmentation, that this is kind of this is something that naturally happens when you've got lots of cooks stirring lots of things into lots of soups.
It's true that that it is. And the riposte that Android developers always give is, well, it's okay because you just have to target the lowest sort of common denominator. That for Android, you know, basically if you're targeting 2.1, 2.2, then you get everything above it. And that's, you know, the vast majority of handsets that are out there. And yet it seems to be at the same time that these numbers just indicate falling interest since sort of middle of last year, because they do these surveys every 3 months. And this falling off in interest, okay, so it's gone from sort of 85 down to 80%. So you'd say, okay, there's still lots of people who are very interested in coding for Android. But it's not what Eric Schmidt was forecasting in December, where he was saying, within 6 months, the first platform you'll be thinking of developing for is Android. No sign of that happening. It's just not taking over in developers. I mean, yeah, with the caveat that this is a particular survey, that this is, you know, not asking every single developer in the world what they're going to do first. But, you know, if this is indicative, which, you know, it seems to be pretty robust because that's a big sample number, then it's indicating that somewhere Android is missing out, that somewhere iOS for Apple, because it's pulling people along, and this is the classic thing that happens with Apple, it sort of has a very eager consumer base, a very eager group of users who update pretty fast. And it's now easier than it ever was to update Apple phones, you know, because it's done over the air with the newest version. Whereas for Android, you have to wait for the mobile carrier to approve it and then to push it out. And actually, the handset manufacturer might not be bothered to do the update. You know, they might say, ice cream sandwich 4.0. Do we really want to go to the trouble of having to code this gingerbread thing and do it? Oh, just leave it. Actually, let's focus on the next handset. We'll make more money out of it. You know, they don't actually have any incentive to do it, whereas Apple is very incentivized to do that, because if it gets its old handsets running the new software, it can sell people all sorts of stuff like TV shows and songs and all those things.
And finally in the news this week, the file sharing service The Pirate Bay announced on their blog that they are dreaming up crazy plans to put their servers in the sky. The Swedish activist organization wrote on their blog that they're looking into a novel way of avoiding shutdown by integrating new radio transmission equipment that has high-speed transmission reaches of up to 50 kilometers and tiny computer systems like the Raspberry Pi, and launching them in small drone aircraft into a system of low-orbit server stations a few kilometers above our heads. I love this. I absolutely love this idea. Charles, is this science fiction?
Yes. You know, someone asked me about this morning, and I said, I'll believe it when the RIAA are shooting them out of the sky.
Well, that would be an act of war, wouldn't it not?
I think they could say that they flew over their property. I mean, you know, let's be realistic about this. Drones have, they function on batteries, you know, or else they've got a bit of fuel in them. They don't fly forever. You know, the US ones, they belong to the army, generally, and the army's sort of got good resources, but even they can't get the damn things to keep flying forever. So either the Pirate Bay would have to buy a lot and keep refueling them, which means landing them, or else it's going to have to put them into geostationary orbit, which is really, really expensive. I suspect that the guys had got some, they got some new stuff over the weekend.
And they had a ball just thinking about it. They were eating too much sugar.
And then they went and had some munchies.
And for more information on any of this week's news stories and the latest news throughout the week, then head to guardian.co.uk/technology. Last week, the computer games industry patted itself on the back at the annual BAFTA Video Games Awards, distributing gongs to the biggest and the best of 2011. Keith, you donned your tux, which we've already established you own, and you went along to the event. How was it?
It was very good fun. It was a really good turnout this year. I think it's getting better and better and more professional every year. It's still not televised yet, like the BAFTA Film Awards, obviously, but you could actually see it on, I think there was some strange satellite channel you could actually watch the highlights on. A few surprises, not too many. I think the biggest one for most was that Elder Scrolls V Skyrim, which was a lot of people's favourite game of last year, didn't figure at all in the awards this year. It was up for sort of 5 or 6 nominations, I think, but it didn't get any of them.
It's like films getting snubbed at the Oscars.
Yeah.
Or at the BAFTAs even.
I think the big winner of the night with 3 awards was Portal 2, which got Best Game, Best Story and Design. And I think it was really, really well deserved. I think it's just one of those games which Avatar the brilliance and the genius of games in such a neat and perfect way. Josh Weir from Valve was there to collect the awards, and I got a quick word with him after the event.
My name is Joshua Weir.
Jonathan Ross, lucky enough to be giving Joshua the award for the best game of the year.
It's amazing that Portal 2 has done so well here, because it's a game that all of us appreciate as gamers, because it's such a beautifully designed title. How do you feel about the awards you've won this year?
You know, we've been saying it all night. I'm just blown away. You know, all year it's kind of been so many incredible games, and to be up here tonight at this awards ceremony winning game of the year, just incredible. I mean, like you said, our fans are so good and so amazing to us. And so to be up here and also get that recognition from the BAFTAs is just incredible.
One of the things I really love about Portal 2, and you might feel the same, Jonathan, is that it makes you feel like you're really, really clever. You feel like when you solve a puzzle, you feel like you're the only person that could have possibly solved it in that way. Yep. How the hell do you design games like that?
It's a lot of figuring out the exact way to just make them feel clever enough, because it's this interesting balance of we have to make you feel a little dumb so that when you feel clever, you feel all the more clever. And that means we have 70 people who come in and sit down through any puzzle and just play it and play it and play it. So it's kind of the science is in the game and the science is behind the game in a weird way. So,
Jonathan, are you a fan of Portal 2?
I'm a fan. Well, you know, I haven't really played Portal 2. I've watched it being played. I've played Portal 1 to more or less completion, which I adore. I love all the Valve games because my son, who is 18 tomorrow, in fact, is addicted to Valve. He loves Valve. We were counting down the minutes to when Portal 2 was downloadable on his Alienware that I bought him for his birthday, because he needed an Alienware to play Valve games on. But we love the whole concept behind it, and the ethos of the company strikes me as being a really healthy and incredibly creative one. You know, the fact that I know when he downloads a game for them, they're not going to disappoint him, and they never have so far, because I know that there's a level of kind of craft but also care and commitment and artistry that goes into their games, which shines through. You know, and I'm not trying to diminish other game makers, there's so many great companies out there. It's one of the things I love about the gaming industry. You know, there's almost everyone who works in it is a fan, you know, and that's not true of most other industries. So, you know, I really respect what they do, and we love what they do, and we thank them for it.
Another thing about Portal is that it's a really, really funny game. And that's what you don't get. I mean, a physics puzzler that's funny. How important do you think the humor is to how people have really come on with the game and really appreciated it?
I think it's absolutely necessary. I mean, like you said, you're being frustrated, you're feeling really clever, but I think that's just not enough, right? Like, if we just did that, then after a while it would run down. So to have that counterpoint, to have that humor that actually makes you laugh out loud, that pulls you forward, that makes you invested into getting even further, is pretty amazing. And like I said, the humor is something where you can sit down with your family and you can all be playing and everybody can kind of enjoy it because everybody's laughing together. And that's a really different social experience than just blowing somebody up or, you know, kind of even working on the puzzles the same way in Portal 2. Like that common thread of humor is just so incredible. And I think Stephen Merchant just did such a great job for us, and also J.K. Simmons, like bringing those characters to life. And of course, Ellen, the voice of GLaDOS, like just incredible cast.
And what's next for Valve? Do you see another Portal in your future?
Actually, something we're working on right now that we're going to start talking about pretty soon is we've built a puzzle creator for Portal 2. So players can actually create their own puzzles and they can share them online through the workshop. So we're going to have a bunch of people making awesome content, sharing with people. So there should be hundreds of awesome puzzles soon.
It's exciting. I mean, it feels to me like it's a real, more now than ever before, like a new frontier of entertainment. You know, with the various different phone platforms that you've got to develop games on, as well as what's happening, and there are still portable gaming machines like the PS Vita, which is an incredible machine. I mean, really, you know, you don't underestimate that. You know, it's hard to see whether that will survive because of the fact that we all use our phones so much now. But it's an incredible piece of technology. The DS 3D was incredible, the 3DS. You know, so all these machines, we've got the new machine from Nintendo coming out hopefully this summer, which I've had a chance to play on, which is incredible. And, you know, Miyamoto knows what he's doing, so that company's going to go, I'm sure, going to continue and survive.
Thank you very much, guys. Thank you.
That was Josh Weir with Jonathan Ross, actually. You managed to
I don't know
corner.
How he got himself. I don't know how he got himself onto those interviews as Josh was going down the carpet. And I don't know. I think Josh was as surprised as everyone else. So,
as with most of these gong ceremonies, there are always a few special awards that are handed out.
Yeah. The BAFTA special award this year went to Marcus Notch Pearson, the creator of Minecraft, which is this enormous PC gaming phenomenon. It's done astonishingly well for something which he started up in his bedroom. It's essentially a video gaming version of Lego. You create a world, all the buildings in it, you mine for resources. It has this blocky graphical look which suits the game really well. And at night, your buildings, whatever you've made, is invaded by zombies and you've got to protect yourself. So it has its part creative and part kind of in monster invasion.
Like chaotic.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a massive phenomenon. It's enormous. It's done millions of downloads. It's now coming onto Xbox Live Arcade in the spring. There's an Android version. Marcus is a really interesting character. He's really kind of inspirational to a new community of young indie coders. And yeah, at the end of the event, I got to have a few quick stolen words with him.
Well, I'm Marcus Notch Pearson. I'm the creator of Minecraft and the founder of Mojang.
Special achievement award this evening. Absolutely amazing. When you look back to when you started on Minecraft and you started planning it, could you ever have foreseen that Minecraft would become what it has become?
No, not even remotely. I was hoping it would kind of be a half year to a year project, and that would make enough money for me to create a new game. And it just exploded far beyond that. Because we got so many dedicated fans early on. So people would talk about the games and get their friends involved and kind of hit YouTube and forums, and it just spread because people talked about the game.
Do you think there's something in gamers that want to be creative? I think Minecraft has answered something with a lot of gamers, and that really what gamers want to do is they don't just want to interact with the world, but they want to really change the world. Do you think that's what it is about Minecraft that's been successful?
Well, perhaps. There are a few other games that have done that. I mean, we have games like Little Big Planet that lets you create entire games. I think the key in Minecraft is that changing the world is the same as playing the game to a large extent. I know there are people who play it creative, but kind of the core game is about changing the world as you play it. So I think that's kind of our magic recipe.
What's the craziest thing you've seen people do with Minecraft? What was the moment where you looked at what someone had done with the Minecraft world and thought, holy shit, what have I done? What have I created?
Well, there's been a few of those. I think the one that's impressed me the most is the full CPU someone made. They made a working computer within Minecraft. It's very slow, but it works. So that is awesome.
What do you think about the other games here this evening? What do you think of the state of the games industry and where Minecraft is in the industry?
I think the state of the industry is amazing. There's a bit of a focus on the AAA titles here, but that's fine. There's a lot of cool stuff happening under the surface. I don't think you have to make super billion profits to be a good game developer. If you can keep your studio afloat and make more money than you're spending, then you're doing a good job. And as long as people are making interesting games, I hope people are able to do that.
What's next? What's next for Notch and Mojang?
Well, I'm going to try making a new game this summer, or starting a new game, which hopefully will be a space game. I won't make Minecraft again. It probably will be very interactive, like Minecraft is, but it's going to be a totally different game.
Congratulations on your award this evening. It's very well deserved.
Thank you very much.
That was Marcus Pearson with Keith. And Keith, award ceremonies would not be award ceremonies if they didn't have personalities and lots of glitz and glamour. And it wasn't just you and your tux. There were other folks there as well.
Yeah, incredibly, that wasn't enough glitz for the BAFTAs. No, they had a few guest presenters for the evening. And actually, the quality of the celebrities are going up in the alphabet. I think we probably started off a few years ago with maybe Y or Z list celebrities were going up. But we had the Saturdays opening the show. They weren't bad. But the presenter was Dario Bryan, who is a good comedian, and also he is genuinely into games. And he's one of the only comedians I know that's got video game culture into his act without it seeming kind of obtuse and without it alienating great amounts of his audience.
So, I want to reference back to Spaced, the fantastic series.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Spaced, they also managed to get computer games into there.
They did. Simon Pegg's very good at that.
And Jessica Stevenson, indeed.
Yeah, so Dario did a good job on the evening. He was someone else I managed to corner in the corridor outside after the show had finished.
Dara, thank you for speaking to us after the BAFTA Awards. You're obviously a gamer. What were the games that you played most out of the games that won the season?
I finished Portal, which is a rare enough sentence that I get to say. I also finished Dead Space 2, which I thought we should have actually done better than it did. And I have given as much time to Skyrim as I ever gave to Portal, which means I'm about 3% of the way through it. Like, Batman I'm playing at the moment. It was, as ever, a massive field of giant contenders. I mean, the biggest surprise is Skyrim not winning anything. I mean, that is astonishing. I think, and it's been mopping up awards in other contexts, but that and Battlefield beating Modern Warfare in the two Battlefield v Modern Warfare categories.
Battlefield did very well. I mean, it won a couple of awards, whereas Modern Warfare didn't win anything.
I mean, that's not unheard of for Modern Warfare not to win things. I mean, I think it's regarded as in this industry being a bit too much of a blockbuster, a bit too mainstream possibly even for this industry. For it to win the game public vote is a turnip for the books, you know, because that was traditionally, I mean, I almost introduced that award by going, next award is the Game 2011 award, so if the team from Modern Warfare would like to start inching their way to the stage, because they constantly win that. But huge surprise, Battlefield was topped them this year. So it's always, I mean, I remember hosting it a number of years ago and saying, and listing off the things that didn't win, and it was Grand Theft Auto 4, Gears of War 2, it was a bit like that this year.
I thought it was quite interesting this year that some of the creative games won. I mean, like Little Big Planet 2, obviously Minecraft got the special award. Do you think this says something about the way our industry is at the moment, and that we're recognising the fact that playing games isn't just about kind of zoning out, but it's about actually being a part of the world?
Listen, I think there's always going to be a place for the linear or passive kind of gaming experience as opposed to the community-based stuff. But it was, you're right, there was a lot of stuff either about innovation in really small games or getting communities like Little Big big plans to start doing the Web 2.0 version of it, where they supply all the content. It's a weird industry. And the one thing strange about this industry at the moment is that it has essentially two price points, which is $45.99 or 69p. And that is weird for it, I think. I think it's still got to find how it can mix and match its developments and budgets and how much it'll be about casual versus hardcore. All that kind of stuff still has to find its balance to a huge extent. But it was reflected in just how random the spread of stuff was.
Dara, thank you very much indeed.
That was Dara O'Brien at the BAFTA Video Games Awards. Keith, are there any other Games Awards like this anywhere in the world?
There are. There's lots in the States. Spike has its own big glittering awards. I think the most interesting ones are probably the IGF, the Independent Games Festival Awards, which happen at the end of GDC and which celebrate independent games. Those are always good because you get lots of British game developers up for them that you would never hear of elsewhere that are celebrated in America, which is nice. And also the Game City Festival in Nottingham, which will take place this October.
I believe you're involved with that, aren't
I
you?
I am, yes. Last year they started a big award, which they wanted to compare to like the Turners or the Booker Prize, in that it was taking one specific game and awarding it for brilliance in its class and in innovation. And that's quite interesting.
But what does something like a BAFTA offer to the video games industry? I mean, that's quite unique.
I think what it does is give video games a kind of cultural standing that they would not get anywhere else. I mean, the Spike TV channel awards in America are all very well, but they're very much geared towards the general gaming demographic. Whereas the BAFTAs instilling a kind of creative orthodoxy on video games is rather special. And they are really passionate. I mean, the head of BAFTA came out and gave a really good speech about how important video games were to BAFTA going forwards. I mean, BAFTA's doing a lot of video game events now. It invites video game developers to talk at BAFTA. It does Q&A sessions with developers. It's really encouraging young student developers in this country as well. It helps out with events for them. So it's really involved. It's not just about those great big heavy awards that it hands out every year. It's also, they do seem to be genuinely trying to invest in the whole culture of games as an art form.
You can find out more at guardian.co.uk/games. That's it for this week's podcast. Many thanks to Charles and Keith. Join us next Tuesday when the next podcast will be up. But this week, the producer was Ian Chambers and I'm Alex Kratosky. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Podcasts, sponsored by audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/free download. Where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.